Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is November 20, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 18. As I speak with you today, we are drawing ever closer to being swallowed up by the evils unleashed two generations ago by a tight network of foundation trustees operating under a false cloak of philanthropy, supposedly for the benefit of others. They actually launched long-range programs designed to grab everything for themselves. Claiming to improve education in the cause of freedom, they actually began replacing education with indoctrination in the cause of collectivism. And while painting themselves as champions of peace, they have led the world into war after war on the road to their version of peace, that is, an all-powerful world government with themselves in control. Blinded by the insatiable greed for power, they could not see that they were opening Pandora's box, setting forces in motion that would ultimately prove impossible to control. Only recently, with disaster looming up fast, have the present-day successors to those original trustees begun awakening to this fact, too late to regain control. Now, only the truth, spread far and wide, can avert total catastrophe. 2 years ago, the United States of America plunged over the brink of a devastating economic collapse as the result of deliberate measures to create stagflation, as I described in my 1973 book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. But the process was arrested partway down because other aspects of the master plan for world domination were slipping behind schedule. As I have related in detail in previous tapes, factors such as the still-concealed Fort Knox gold and plutonium scandals, reverses in the Middle East, Indira Gandhi's upset of the CIA in India, and other things have caused our unseen rulers enormous difficulties for over 18 months. But time is running out, and it is do or die for those who seek to enslave us. So now, the United States has at last been pried loose from its temporary economic foothold, and we are falling slowly but helplessly, like a dreamer in a nightmare, toward the dreaded economic depression far below. Politically, the phantom election plan I revealed last month, by which Nelson Rockefeller still plans to become America's chief executive, is proceeding so far exactly as planned. 68% of the voting precincts nationwide had voting machines on November 2, 1976, and where they jammed all across the country, there was no provision for paper ballots. Thousands of ballots were lost in certain areas. The legality of thousands of others is being challenged, and recounts are underway in some places. The net result, exactly as planned, was an extremely close popular vote and no landslide for anyone. President Gerald Ford thought he had the election in the bag, having been promised by Nelson Rockefeller that he would carry New York State. But the pained expression on Ford's face as his wife delivered his concession statement on November 3rd, was nothing compared to the shock that awaits Jimmy Carter if the plan now underway succeeds. Meanwhile, as the stage is being set for economic and political shocks in America, we drift ever closer to war and a declaration of national emergency that could spell the end of our freedoms. And the dangerous intelligence gap created by Henry Kissinger continues. When I recorded monthly audio letter number 17 on October 26th, last month, I mentioned that the Soviet Union already knew where our lost Phoenix missile was in the North Sea, but had not retrieved it. I had just learned of the missile's location and revealed it in that tape. On October 27th, the following day, as soon as the tape was released, I also relayed it to military intelligence. That same day, Navy spokesman told the press that they still had not located the Phoenix, but using the information I relayed to them, the Navy found and retrieved the Phoenix missile on October 31st. The United States government would have you believe it is mere coincidence that they suddenly found the Phoenix after I revealed its location, even though the Navy had spent 6 weeks in a fruitless search prior to that. There are also those who would have you believe that General George S. Brown, the top military officer in the United States, met with me for more than an hour on September 16, 1976, in his Pentagon office out of idle curiosity. And especially, there are many who want you to believe there will be no reason for the Soviet Union to do as I have charged, planting underwater-launched nuclear missiles within our own territorial waters. But nothing, my friends, could be further from the truth. What the Soviet Union has done and is doing is completely logical and to be expected if we look at it from their point of view. As Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, leader of the Conservative Party in England, recently said, and I quote, "The danger is our Western tendency to assume that other people will apply our own standards and values. When considering international matters, the important thing is not to look at other nations as if we were standing in their shoes, but as if they were standing in their shoes." Unquote. If you depend, as most Americans do, on the controlled major media for your understanding of the world, you will never learn to think this way, nor can you hope to grasp the real issues that govern military survival. Yet such understanding is essential if we are to see how to correct our dangerous situation. One organization, which in my opinion does do an excellent job of clarifying matters of defense and national security, is the American Security Council, located at Ballston, Virginia. Their zip is 22713. I recommend the Council as an excellent source of information for every concerned American. To help in understanding the threat we now face and how we got into such a position, I will discuss the following three topics today. Topic number one, the mushrooming debate over Soviet military power. Topic number two, why the Soviet Union wants nuclear war. And topic number three, how governmental and press secrecy are destroying our chances for peace. Topic number one, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has said over and over again for nearly a decade, quote, "Détente or nuclear holocaust. There is no third way," unquote. With this in mind, public discussion of American-Soviet relations has focused for years on the alleged happy fruits of détente, the growing thaw between East and West, and so forth. But lately, there has been an ominous change. President Ford dropped the word détente from his active vocabulary, and mounting concern over the ragged condition of NATO forces has been expressed increasingly by European and American leaders. Just last week, two so-called prestigious groups burst upon the public scene to churn up controversy over the issues of mounting Soviet military power. First, on November 11, came the Committee for the Present Danger, urging presumed President-elect Carter to increase military spending instead of decreasing it as promised during the election campaign. Then 3 days later, a study group financed by the Rockefeller Foundation proposed the opposite, that we undertake joint military reductions with the Soviet Union, perhaps initiating the process with selected unilateral reductions of our own. And the warnings continue. Just 3 days ago, a representative of Boeing Aerospace Company testified before Congress that in case of nuclear war, 98% of the Soviet population would survive because of the elaborate civil defense precautions being taken there. By contrast, of course, the United States has no civil defense program worthy of the name. Obviously, détente is fading from the official scene rapidly. According to the Kissinger formula, that means nuclear holocaust is on its way. But where did he get that formula? The word détente is just another word for what was termed peaceful coexistence in the early 60s. And the Kissinger formula first emerged in October 1959 in the form, quote, peaceful coexistence or nuclear holocaust, there is no third way, unquote. But the speaker then was not Henry Kissinger. It was Nikita Khrushchev. The peaceful coexistence idea, which later became so-called détente, began 20 years ago when Khrushchev announced a major new Soviet policy line, namely that war with the West was not inevitable after all, contrary to the teachings of Lenin. Instead, the nuclear age had made peaceful coexistence necessary. To most Westerners, this sounded like live and let live. But to the Soviet Union, it meant only the avoidance of a war which could destroy the Soviet Union. It was all right to continue to break off chunks of the free world by intrigue, subversion, and so-called wars of national liberation, such as those which have occurred in Vietnam, Angola, and elsewhere. The Soviet Union concentrated on selling the idea of peaceful coexistence for 5 years, from 1956 to 1961, ably assisted by their allies here in the United States. Then, in 1961, a major new phase began as John F. Kennedy became President of the United States. For decades, the state socialists who run the Soviet Union had been in alliance with and supported by the corporate socialists whose control over the United States was growing ever more complete. Now at long last, the time was ripe to launch their well-orchestrated joint program that was to lead to complete dictatorial control of the United States by the corporate socialists, Soviet conquest of vast areas of the world piecemeal with corporate socialist assistance, and finally, joint domination of the entire world by the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance. The basic idea of the program was for the strength and resolve of the United States to be undermined and sapped while the Soviet Union will be enabled to forge ahead into unprecedented world power. Communism would be made appear to be the wave of the future, while American morale and faith in our free system of government would be steadily eroded. Finally, according to plan, the United States would be in the process of increasing encirclement and vulnerability, more and more countries becoming Soviet satellites, with the unseen help of American corporate socialists who would share in the spoils. Economic disaster, military vulnerability, and the collapse of our own self-confidence would, according to plan, open the door for dictatorship here in America. The single most critical step in this long-range plan began to be taken in 1961, the progressive shutoff of critical research and development programs for future military technology. If research uncovers a basic new concept at a given point in time, it will ordinarily be 5 to 15 years before it can be translated into a new operational technology. In between, there must be development, experimentation, evaluation, and full-scale production programs. By the same token, if research and development are cut off at some point, 5 to 15 years later, you will not have the new technology available that would otherwise have come into being. Early justifications for the dwindling R&D program were based on fond new hopes for disarmament in connection with the new Soviet stance in favor of peaceful coexistence. Later, as the conflict in Vietnam grew into a major war, it became easier to leave important R&D items out of the already swollen defense budget. Another key ingredient in the overall plan was to be the use of Cuban troops as proxies in Soviet so-called wars of national liberation in Latin America and elsewhere. The Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, a few short months after Kennedy took office, could have produced a serious setback for the Rockefeller Soviet plans for overthrow of numerous governments, so Kennedy's advisors carefully steered him away from making the invasion a success. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union constructed long-range plans to take advantage of the American disadvantage in military technology that was being arranged to occur in the mid-1970s. While our R&D began to decline, theirs accelerated. By knowing exactly what to expect, the Soviet Union was able to target its military development toward achievement of a dominant position 15 years later, and that time has now arrived. In 1962, however, a gamble by Nikita Khrushchev almost caused the whole plan to come apart. For more than a year, a prominent United States Senator, Kenneth Keating, had been sounding warnings that offensive nuclear missiles were being placed in Cuba by the Soviet Union. But his charges were denied by the administration, just as my charges about Soviet underwater missiles are being plausibly denied now. But President Kennedy finally decided to look into it himself personally instead of accepting blind assurances that there was nothing to it from his advisors. He found out that the charges were true and the Cuban Missile Crisis was upon us. The Cuban Missile Crisis led to the elimination from the scene of both Kennedy and Khrushchev. First, as I revealed in Monthly Audio Letter Number 3 for August 1975, President Kennedy was murdered because he was becoming increasingly dangerous to the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance. He had come into office lacking any real grasp of the realities of international politics, but he was learning, and learning fast. It was clearly only a matter of time before he would get around to reversing the cutoff of our critical R&D programs. Already, he was initiating steps intended to turn off our involvement in Vietnam. Khrushchev, for his part, took longer to oust, since his power had to be chipped away carefully by his enemies in the Kremlin. But finally, he was removed for jeopardizing the long-range plan of conquest with a dangerous gamble that failed. Looking ahead toward the increasing opportunities that would present themselves for the Soviet Union to benefit at America's expense, the Institute of the United States of America was founded early in the 1960s in Moscow. This institute, whose purpose is to study the vulnerabilities of the United States, was founded with the help of financing from the Rockefeller Foundation. Once the Oval Office was inhabited by Lyndon Johnson, the grand plan proceeded onward without further difficulty. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara played an especially important role in several ways. The period during which he served, from 1961 to 1968, was one in which research and development carried out prior to the R&D cutoff would potentially be continuing to bear fruit. But McNamara, doing the bidding of those who had placed him in that position, succeeded in causing the cancellation of important advanced weapons programs, decommissioning of many defense installations, physical scrapping of huge quantities of defense materiel, and costly concentration of effort on ill-fated programs such as the F-111 multipurpose Air Force Navy fighter. He also championed the impressive-sounding theory of warfare called measured response, which guaranteed the escalation of Vietnam into a major war by preventing clear-cut, decisive wins in battle. As his reward for such valuable service, McNamara was made president of the World Bank. Can you imagine? With the inauguration of President Richard M. Nixon on January 20, 1969, the Kissinger era of foreign policy emerged in full bloom. Kissinger had been an influential voice in government since the early 60s, thanks to his association with Nelson Rockefeller that began in 1955. Now, he became one of the most important Rockefeller Soviet agents in the United States government. Following the outlines of the long-range plan, he became known as the architect of so-called détente, repeating Khrushchev's old formula, peaceful coexistence or nuclear holocaust, almost verbatim. In 1972, détente entered a new phase. The SALT I agreement was signed in Moscow by President Nixon in May of that year. Meanwhile, the same year, the Soviet Union launched the massive drive in civil defense that has lately started attracting attention. The Soviet Union could see that the long-awaited opportunity to pull ahead of the United States was fast approaching. That same year, 1972, saw the expansion of so-called détente to Red China. Kissinger also played a central role in this development, but far from promoting real peace, Kissinger was undoing a golden opportunity for freedom for a quarter of the world's people and possibly peace for the entire world. What I am about to tell you is top secret, and I am revealing it for the very first time. Some years ago, an international entrepreneur whom I will call Smith was in the act of selling a large European bank when he was approached by a Chinese on a business venture involving a retired Chinese general whom I will call Lee. Lee had known both Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong very well during earlier revolutionary days, and was still closely associated with six regional military chieftains in Red China who were all genuinely anti-Soviet in every way. Moreover, after the turmoil that took place in Red China in 1957 and later, these Chinese military chieftains became completely disenchanted and disgusted with Mao's program of using young hoodlums to terrorize and murder all suspected opposition to his dictatorial and oppressive programs. Mao's euphemistic term, cultural revolution, for these cutthroat methods of bending the people to his will did not impress them. They contacted Lee and queried him as to the possibility of getting American support in case they should decide to overthrow Mao and establish a republic using the customary parliamentary form of government. Those who preferred the security of socialism would be allowed to live in communes, but the government would foster a free market system for the country as a whole. General Lee arranged through the United States Department of State to send envoys through the bamboo curtain to make the necessary arrangements. But someone in the State Department leaked the information to Red Chinese officials, and all of the envoys were quickly apprehended and put to death. Nevertheless, General Lee persisted. He asked Mr. Smith if he could arrange for broadcasting equipment to inform all of Red China what was taking place, why the military deemed it necessary to overturn Mao, and what form of government would be established. Smith agreed to contact certain top officials in the United States government close to the president. However, General Lee emphasized that he must circumvent Henry Kissinger and get the ear of Mr. Nixon only, since Lee did not trust Kissinger nor anyone else in the State Department. The contacts were made, but unfortunately, a member of another agency heard of the plan and briefed President Nixon about it in front of Kissinger. Almost immediately, arrangements were made for Kissinger to visit China to meet secretly with Mao. This meeting took place, and at the meeting, Kissinger informed Mao that he would be overthrown by a military coup unless Mao's regime chose to cooperate with those who held the real power in the United States. To sweeten the deal for Mao, certain secret agreements were made concerning the future course of American relationships with the Republic of China on Taiwan. The outgrowth of the meeting was ping-pong diplomacy, the Nixon summit trip to Peking in February 1972, and so-called détente between Red China and the United States. In return, Mao Zedong's iron-handed dictatorship over Red China was rendered secure once again. Red China would thus continue to be a controllable threat to the Soviet Union. With any real threat to the Soviet Union from the direction of Red China taken care of, the Rockefeller Soviet plan continued. Last year, the Helsinki Accord gave the Soviet Union essentially what she had wanted for 20 years, a ratification of her conquests in Eastern Europe. By thus signaling to the imprisoned countries behind the Iron Curtain that we consider them to be within the Soviet sphere, we reduce any tendency they might have to revolt in case of war. The Soviet Western flank is thus made far more secure than before. In the past several years, countries have been falling into the Soviet orbit at a quickening pace, with their domination shared secretly by their corporate socialist allies here in America. At the same time, the declining military might of the United States and the fast increasing threat from the Soviet Union has finally become too obvious to hide any longer. This stage, too, was foreseen and planned. All of the economic, political, and military factors are intended to lead to a declaration of national emergency here in America, dictatorship, and war. But as it turned out, there is a terrible joker in the deck that has been dealt by the Rockefeller Empire in its hidden collaboration with the Soviet Union. The war to come, Nuclear War I, waged primarily on American soil, was supposed to be neatly limited and controlled, with a nuclear safe zone set aside for the Soviet allies here in America, as I revealed in monthly audio letter number 12 last May. But the Soviet Union has for months been maneuvering to carry out a double cross at this critical stage in America's increasing vulnerability. They want to seize all the marbles for themselves.